All right, just a couple of things again. Probably this will be the last announcement for another month on the Living Grace need, and we'll, once we get that met, we'll let you know. And also, just a reminder, we will not have class 2 weeks from today. That is June 5th, the 5th through the 11th. We will be off and resume here the 12th. All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship. Let's continue on here dealing with this matter of Paul's boasting eschatologically, but the things he would allow for boasting, which it makes perfect sense. It's things related to the Lord and what he's done, his abilities, his actions, and not us, not what we've done. So we close there with both boasting in our testing, and then 2 Corinthians 12:9. Paul talks about boasting in his weaknesses. 2 Corinthians 12:9. And this is where Paul got this thorn in the flesh that was allowed to buffet him. And the word is one for a beating, for physical abuse. But I haven't done this passage, so I don't know specifically what all is involved here. Obviously, it's demonic in some way, a messenger of Satan, but what all is involved in that, we don't know. But it was bad enough that Paul said, I implored the Lord three times in verse 8 that it may leave me. So apparently it was with him all the time. And he has said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake. Again, it has to be for Christ's sake. It's not just a general situation of one in which people are happy with bad things happening, but these are things that come as a direct result of his service for the Lord and his relationship with him. For when I am weak, then I am strong. And the idea is the power of God is best shown through human weakness, that his power shows up by contrast all the more. So it was also evident that Paul recognized it was appropriate to boast about his congregations and their orientation to the principles of the truth. 2 Corinthians 7:4. And the Corinthians were, again, a real mixed bag, as we know. But I don't think Paul intentionally tries to flatter them or inappropriately tries to butter them up. I think there are people that there are applying that are oriented, and that Paul knows about that. And he talks about that in 7:4. Great is my confidence in you. Great is my boasting on behalf. The idea is extensive. I am filled with comfort. I am overflowing with joy in all our affliction. Also 8:24. Here I believe he's again exhorting the Corinthians in regard to this matter of the grace offering for Jerusalem. Therefore, openly before the churches, show them the proof of your love and show them the proof of why we boast about you, our reason for boasting about you. Then 9:2, for I know your readiness, of which I boast about you to the Macedonians. And he would boast about one congregation to the other as a form of encouragement and also as a form of motivation. That we want Paul to be proud of us as well, the Macedonian churches. Namely, that Achaia has been prepared since last year, and your zeal has stirred up most of them, and not the entire province, but the churches that were in that province, like Corinth. The churches in Macedonia, Philippi, and Thessalonica, and others. And then 2 Thessalonians 1:4. Therefore, we ourselves speak proudly of you, We boast about you, is the idea, among the churches of God for your perseverance and your faith. And he has good grounds for boasting about them. Their patience and their faith in the midst of all their persecutions and afflictions, which they endure. Obviously, as we see one another going through difficulties and struggles and challenges, when we face them and we bear up under those things, it's an encouragement to other believers. Some believers, I don't think they even concern themselves with trying to encourage other believers. I think they're in it for themselves. And realistically, we're not supposed to be. I mean, we just covered Philippians 2 there, which says you're not supposed to be in it for yourself. So again, Paul had reason, good reason for boasting about these people. They had endured persecution and suffering by their countrymen, just as Paul had endured by the hands of the Jews. He boasted about them. So although it may sound like Paul will boast about his ministry and his success, such is not the case. Rather, his boasting deals with what God has accomplished by means of grace through imperfect men and their labors. It's not, look what I've done. It's, look what God has done in me and through me. Not because I'm anything, but because God gets the glory for all of this. That's what he's boasting about. He recognizes his own shortcomings. The timing of his boasting, point 21, is related to the eschatological reality of the day of Christ, which once again provides proper motivation for living in the present. While the content of his boasting is introduced by the conjunction haughty. Again, I will boast that I have not wasted my time, that God has worked in you and through me and has used us to do his will. 22, the use of the preposition eis, into, on, or during, indicates that Paul is not speaking of boasting in the present or boasting that continues until the day of Christ. But rather, this boasting is to take place in the future day of Christ. And as noted in chapter 1, the day of Christ Jesus is to be understood as the future event central to Pauline eschatology. It finds its origins in the Old Testament concept of the day of Yahweh. I'm going to go out there and shut the kid up. While the Old Testament, point 24, day of the Lord, strongly emphasized the idea of judgment. For Paul, the day of Christ emphasized the matter of glory and reward that would come from that evaluation. And so he recognizes that the day is coming. And of course, this is part of our present motivation, is recognizing what we face in the future and preparing for that, so that we are not among those who slink away in shame at his coming and have to be embarrassed at the Bema Seat. That's not what we're after. 1 Thessalonians 1:10. And to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead. That is Jesus, who rescues us from the wrath to come. Also that's part of that eschatological deliverance, is that we're delivered from wrath. But the last part of the, Daniel 70th week specifically, all the wrath is unleashed. 2 Timothy 4:8. In the future. There is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, of which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but to all who have loved his appearing. This is what he looks forward to. This is the motivation. You don't want to appear ashamed at the Bema Seat. You don't want to find out, as you walk away and they call you smoky because all your phase two was burned up because you didn't really apply. For some people, they'll apply up to a point and then they stop and then they go off and live their lives. But God still rewards what they did. Also, 1 John, the last one here, 1 John 4. 4:17. By this, love is perfected in us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment. Because as he is, so also are we in this world. And that our union with him identifies us with him, not only positionally, but we are to live that out in our daily lives, reflecting his will and all of that. So although it may sound like Paul, again, will boast about his... Where am I here? Okay, point 25. The day of Christ, I got it behind myself. The day of Christ deals with the eschatological consummation following the church age, which involves the exaltation and glorification of Christ and those that belong to him. It begins technically with the end of the age of Israel, which is the final part of Daniel's 70th week. That's the age, that's the period that's missing in that prophecy from Daniel 9. That there were 70 weeks determined upon your people and all of that. And there's a week missing when you go in and do all the math. There's a week missing, and it's 77s, literally. And it deals with seven-year periods. So for all church-age believers, the day of Christ, that should be day of Christ, will commence at the rapture, which involves believers being caught up to meet the Lord and then standing before him at the Bema Seat. Romans, I think, just informs us that we are going to be there, whereas the, well, actually, both of these do that, actually. Romans 14:10, one of them talks about the judgment seat of Christ, and one talks about the judgment seat of God. For you, and here's motivation again. Why do you judge your brother? Or again, why do you regard your brother with contempt? Because we'll all stand, see, you're not the judge. I'm not the judge. The judge is coming, all right. And he will evaluate people because he will have all the facts. And he will evaluate people perfectly. And we will all stand before the judgment seat of God, and he will do the judging. And so that is motivation for us to avoid judgment, being judgmental towards other believers in time. 2 Corinthians 5:10. And one might argue, the Bema Seat, how important is it? It's only mentioned twice in the New Testament. Yeah, but you don't have to mention that a lot to know. And as a general rule, the fact is the Jews recognized there was a coming judgment. People have a fear of it, even unbelievers out there. I mean, I was afraid of it. I was afraid of God judging me. I didn't want to go to hell. And so people may be aware of it. So you don't have to mention this very much because it is such a serious thing. And in fact, there's nothing else like it. 2 Corinthians 5:10, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed, that is, paid back, rewarded, for his deeds in the body, according to what he has done. The good deeds that we know will be rewarded. But again, it's not bad deeds, it's worthless. The word means worthless. It's those things you did out of fellowship or for the wrong motivation or whatever it was. You didn't produce divine good. That energy is lost. And those deeds won't be rewarded. And we'll all have some of that, no doubt. I mean, it'd be nice if we were perfect and didn't have to worry about that. But that's, again, part of the motivation for striving to be better, for striving for spiritual growth. Because we know this is coming. So this evaluation, point 27, does not concern itself with the sins of believers. Rather, it involves an evaluation of their stewardship and orientation to God's plan following salvation, how they lived their Christian lives. And as we pointed out, we were doing the book of Ecclesiastes, and it wasn't until I did that book, 1 Corinthians 4, that I recognized that life is a gift from God, but life is also a stewardship. It's both. God gives it freely. But God has expectations of how you should use it. And really, realistically, if God gave you life, it's his life anyway to give. So this is why, again, murder. You don't have the right to take life. And we could fix a lot of this if we would just start doing public executions. Speedy trials. You go in and you shoot up a mall or a shopping center or whatever, you will have you before the judge the next day. You're going to be arraigned. We will have you on trial for 2 weeks, and if found guilty of murder, we will execute you on public television. That would put some fear in people. Let them watch a public execution. And whether it's firing squad or lethal injection or electric chair, old Sparky, but put it on TV and let. And this is why the Romans put their crosses right at the crossroads, not because of the cross, they wanted everybody to see it. They wanted it broadcast as far as it could go, because it sent a very powerful message. If you cross the Roman Empire, this is what you have to look forward to. But our country's not going to do that. We're going to cater to the criminals. We'll coddle them and blame the victims. That's our country. We'll have unrighteous judges, turn them loose, and cowardly juries who don't have the pass a death penalty on a person that should have it passed on them. They don't have the sense to do it. And so what do we have? We have this chaos. We have culture descending into madness and insanity because they get away with it. And now we'll put them up in prison and take care of them for 20, 30, 40 years. And they aren't going to come out any better. If you think a killer is going to be rehabilitated by sending him to prison, he's not. Salvation is the only thing that's probably going to change him. Well, here, let a man regard us in this manner. If you want to evaluate us and think about us, here's how you should. That we are servants of Christ and that we are stewards of the mysteries of God. And in this case, moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. But to me, it's a very small thing that I may be examined by you or by any human court. And in fact, I do not even examine myself. For I am conscious of nothing against myself, yet by this, I am not by this acquitted. I may not be aware of something I'm doing wrong. God may be, Paul says. But the one who examines me is the Lord. And again, this matter of the coming judgment and the fact that he is perfect is motivation not to engage in sinful judging. Believers are going to have to live their Christian lives. They may not do it always to your satisfaction or mine, but that doesn't matter. They have to do it. They have to answer for it. You can pray for them, encourage them, but don't be a discouragement to them. That's the whole point. Well, 28, since Paul recognized that his ministry would be evaluated by Christ, he urges the Philippians to live in such a way, by holding fast to doctrine, as to provide evidence that his ministry had been successful under the grace of God. And 29, at the end of the verse, he mixes two metaphors, which he uses in other places to deal with the execution of the ministry that God had given him. And again, I there's no way to do it sometimes, but I'd almost like to be consciously get rid of the word "the" in front of ministry, because to people it implies a public ministry, pastoring or something like that. But ministry is the responsibility of all believers. They are to minister as priests of God, living the Christian life, representing man to God and God to man, to unbelievers. And then, of course, encouraging and all of that, building up, edifying other believers. 30 here, the two verbs are aorist. Since they look back from the standpoint of the day of Christ, the aorist is generally, although the aorist is timeless, it's generally used in a historic way. So at the day of Christ, he looks back and says, well, here's my race I ran. Now I ran it, it's over. Here's my labors. I've done them. It is at this future time again that Paul's life and work will be examined. And Paul saw the similarities between how he conducted his ministry and how those that engaged in running in the games conducted themselves. He also compares his ministry to those who worked as manual laborers in the Roman Empire. 32, Paul referred to the foot race more often than any of the other athletic events that he mentions in his writing, which likely influenced Luke and Hebrews. I would almost wager that it did. The doctrine in Hebrews is very much a reflection of Paul's theology. And Luke writes the same way. He uses the definite article to particularize the sin nature. When he's talking about that, he uses the definite article with death to particularize spiritual death specifically. And so these all have the athletic metaphors. 1 Corinthians 9, 24 through 27. And each of these passages has a little to contribute with respect to the manner of how one is to compete in the Christian life, viewing it as a competition. Now, we're not in competition with each other. It's not a contest for us. We're not in competition with other believers. We're in competition with ourselves. And running our race. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? And that's tantamount to the crown, the Stephanos, the victor's wreath. Run in such a way that you may win. Now, there was more to it in the victor's wreath. They were exempt from taxes. They got sometimes a monetary reward. Obviously, there was a lot of fame, and you were a celebrity for a while, and all of that. So there's things that come to winners that other people don't get. But you have to compete in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. I don't shadow box. And anybody that's engaged in boxing knows for a fact that it is, you use more energy to throw a punch and miss than you do to land a punch. So you don't want to miss when you're boxing. That's the goal. Now, I know people don't understand war, that the design is to kill all your enemies. And, we got to have rules for war. International rules for war. That's interesting. I wonder what Caesar would have thought of that. He would have laughed and went in the head and slaughtered him. That's exactly what he would have done. But we have rules for these things. We don't know how. And I think if I understand boxing, the goal is to beat your opponent. The goal is to put him on his back. The goal isn't to just hit him. It's to stop him. To put him down permanently, if you can. I mean, for the fight, you're not trying to kill him. But there are people who have died in the boxing ring or died as a result of wounds sustained in the boxing ring. It's a brutal sport. So our do-good society, we don't have anything to do with it anymore. But it is a real contest between men. And when these guys train, whether they're runners or boxers, you look at the regimen that they endure. They will go without food. They will go without water to get to their make weight and get to their weigh-in. And then, they eat tons of calories, but they avoid other things. They avoid sex before competitions. They avoid wasting a lot of time. They stay in training all the time. The elite athletes do. They can't compartmentalize and say, okay, well, I'm taking this 6 months to just do nothing. You come back after 6 months of doing nothing, you're not going to be competitive. And that's why you watch these guys, even like Tom Brady. You know, they retire for, what, 3 weeks? I knew he wasn't retiring. I have no idea why he even ever issued that statement. That's beyond me. He's not retiring. He thinks he could play till he's 50. We'll see. I don't know. If he does, he'll be the oldest. Well, almost one of the oldest. Well, I discipline my body and I make it my slave, so that after I have proclaimed the truth to others, I myself will not be disqualified. You can also see Galatians 2, 2 and 5, 7. Those just reference it. 2:16 in Philippians is our verse. Philippians 3 is the next one. Coming up in the next chapter. Brothers, I do not regard myself as having laid hold of it yet. And hold of it is absolute perfection. That he's become mature to the point where there's no further growth possible. That he's reached the end of his spiritual growth in that sense. And he said, I don't think that's happened. And one thing I do. Forgetting, and I think these are plurals in verse 13, if I remember right, forgetting what things lie behind, the things behind, and reaching forward to the things that are in front of me. One of the things you have to be, and you can see this, golfing is a good example of this, that you have to have a real short memory. You know, when you go out and muck up a hole and make a triple bogey, you can't take that to the next tee. You can't afford to beat yourself up. You've played the hole. You've got to put it behind you and move on. And I've watched golfers who can't do that. And they get in a deal, they mess up a hole, and it destroys the rest of their round. Since I'm no good, it doesn't bother me as much. But I haven't golfed in quite a while anyway. But I do not regard myself. And he doesn't use, quote, a racing metaphor as much as just running. I press on. I move on towards the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. And the prize is the victor's wreath, the crown. He hasn't won it yet. It's not guaranteed until we get there. And so Paul knows all this. He's humble, recognizes, okay. And he says, any of us that are claimed to be mature, you got to have this same attitude. I'm in it to win it. And again, not to beat others, but to get the glory. 2 Timothy 4:7. Oh, that's where Paul, I know, let's look at Hebrews. Now, Paul says, I've run the race, I have completed my course, I have fought the good fight. And so he recognizes his race is over. Hebrews 12. I remember when Stuart was close to death, that's what I told him. Well, your race is over. You've run yours. I'm jealous, but that's the way it goes. So therefore, as he says, we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us. Let us lay aside every encumbrance and the old sin nature which so easily entangles us. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. And of course, in the foot race, more so than, say, golf or boxing, although boxing, any physically demanding contest, is going to require endurance. They used to, I don't know if, what they still do now because I don't watch boxing much anymore, but used to, and you know, all championship fights were 15 rounds. And if you ran out of gas in the 12th, too bad. You lose. You could be beating him the whole fight, but you run out of gas in the last round and take a big punch and you lose. So endurance is a big part of this. Sticking with it. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So the verb Paul uses in this regard is trekka, to advance, to move forward, to run, which was used in classical Greek to refer to moving quickly or to running. It should be running. It was also used especially of the running contests in the stadium. While many may be familiar with the Isthmian Games or the Olympic Games, the Isthmus Games were there in Achaia. They were on the southern part of Greece. The Olympic Games, we know, were in Athens. Many were not familiar with what was actually involved in preparing for and competing in the Games. Athletics were considered to be extremely important in the Greco-Roman world and were approached with great effort and passion, which partly explains why Paul applied this imagery to the Christian life. He expects us to approach it with great energy and great passion, that this is our life. It is not just something we do. This has to govern everything we do. So this explains why I applied it to the Christian way of life. And in any sporting competition, the goal was never merely to participate. Now you see the little trophies that say participant. That's disgusting. That ought to be outlawed. But they're not going to outlaw it. People are crazy. Oh, you competed. You showed up. Okay, well, I'll have some trophies here for y'all next Sunday for participants. Everybody that's here gets one. You can take it home. Show it on your mantle how proud you are. I participated. Well, the goal was never merely to participate. The goal was to win. And again, that's also been bastardized in our culture and made into a crime, that you want to win. I'm not saying people don't take it to extreme. If you have to cheat to win, you didn't win. You cheated. But to win fair and square and play by the rules. Our culture, no, we just think you should show up. And you're a winner just by being here. No, you're not. Even in Bible class, you're not a winner just by being here. What if you're not listening? What if your mind's off thinking about, man, I want a hamburger. I'm getting hungry. Now that's all anybody will think about. Shouldn't have mentioned it. The goal was to win, not only because winning brought numerous blessings, but because in most cases, those who lost were subject to disgrace. And this is where Christians don't get it. They're going to be disgraced, a lot of them. And the fact of losing made you a disgrace. And you couldn't just get rid of that. It was public. And you might wear off and pass over time. But it was disgraceful to lose in the games. So the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, from 45 to 135 AD, noted that in the Olympic Games, you cannot just be beaten and then depart. But first of all, you will be disgraced, not only before the people of Athens or Sparta, but before the whole world. Well, that's a little bit of hyperbole. Obviously, everybody in the world doesn't know. But that point was, the disgrace was big. It was expansive. And in the second place, if you withdraw without sufficient reason, you will be whipped. If you signed up for the games and didn't follow through, they beat you. Maybe we could try that. All you Christians that aren't applying, get ready, I'm coming. With the club. And with the beatings will commence until you are encouraged. You know, what was that old deal? The beatings will continue till morale increases. Well, we can't do that. We don't have that freedom or luxury. But believers ought to be disgraced, and they ought to recognize their shame, but they didn't even have the sense to do that. That's what's sad. They don't even recognize it, and we're going to get that coming up. They glory in the things they should be ashamed of. They think they're making some kind of stand for the truth, when in fact they're abusing the truth and rejecting it. Well, Paul recognized that the games, particularly the race, required the expenditure of his energies. He viewed his ministry as a passionate struggle that demanded his full exertion if he was to be successful. And the struggle for success not only demanded his unrelenting effort, it also required significant amounts of self-denial. We saw that in the Corinthian passage. Those who compete in the game exercise self-control in all things. So a couple of other factors in the racing analogy, point 35 here, address the manner in which the athlete must compete. 1 Corinthians 9:26, to run in such a way as not without aim. In other words, the distance runner knew this, and I've told you this many times. He had a focal point, a point of focus ahead of him, so that he ran towards that to keep himself running in a straight line. And this is one of the things people maybe are not aware of, but you always favor one side or the other. And if you were just lost out in the middle of nowhere, eventually, if you walked a while, you'll probably end up going in a very large circle because of the side you favored. But if you keep a focal point and you keep lined up in front of you the direction you're heading, you won't have that problem because you can walk that line because you can see it, as it were. Well, the image of running aimlessly deals with a couple of things. First, it could refer to an athlete wandering around the track and not staying in his own lane. That's part of the rules of competition, too. And if you ever watch any of the games, every once in a while, I still like to watch track and field, especially the sprints. You know, the 10,000 meters takes forever, so... if you want to watch them run for a long time, you can watch that one. But pole vault and high jump and things like that, long jump. But the races, and particularly in the track, the lanes are all very clearly marked. And if you step out of that lane one time, you're disqualified. Doesn't matter what happens. If you step out of the lane, you're disqualified. Even if you are 10 yards ahead of everybody else, you lose. You finish last because you're DQ'd. So again, if you don't stay in your own lane, and this gets the idea in the Christian life, that God has a lane for us to run in. It's called the straight and narrow. And that lane is that, straight and narrow. It doesn't allow for a lot of deviation. Doesn't allow for a lot of ad-libbing. God has a plan for us, and our job is to be patient, figure it out what it is, and execute it. And what we know is he's at work with us already to do this. We just have to cooperate with him. He's at work in us to will and to do his good pleasure. So secondly, it addresses the matter of the finish line. The runner sought to keep the finish line in sight, so as to run in a straight line and not veer off course. And C, knowing the rules of the competition was critical. All athletes were required to compete lawfully, observing the rules that govern the competition. 2 Timothy 2:5, where Paul tells young Timothy that this is a part of his deal, and that if anyone competes as an athlete, whatever the game, he's not talking necessarily here just about racing, but anything, whether it's wrestling, running, other competitions, boxing, basketball, he does not win the prize unless he competes according to the rules. Unless you're the Houston Astros. In which case, you can cheat and get away with it. Oh, they finally caught him, but they won the World Series. But again, if you have to cheat to win, doesn't that tarnish your victory? Don't you have any normal pride? That I had to cheat to win and I put something over on people? That's ridiculous. That's disgusting. So again, you had to know the rules. And any athlete found in violation of the rules could be whipped, fined, and then disqualified from competing again. This also resulted in his public disgrace. Now, can you imagine that in the NBA? If they foul out after 6 fouls, then you whip them on the court. I think it'd clean the game up. But we can't do that. Now they've gotten to where on certain things they do penalize them. Not very much. They penalize them $25,000 when they're making $25 million. That really stung. Not really. So again, public disgrace, and that didn't quickly go away. So therefore, the runner must know the course and not attempt to deviate it, lest he be disqualified. That's our Hebrews passage. We've got to run the race keeping the goal in view. So it is clear that the reason for all this effort, self-denial, and commitment was so the athlete could win the prize and obtain the victor's wreath, which is also referred to as the prize. We saw that in the 1 Corinthians 9 passage there. I want to win the prize. That's the goal. Not just to show up, to win. And anything less than that is really a bastardization of athletics in general. It's not what athletics are meant to be. And some people I recognize are more competitive. You don't want to have board game night with certain people, maybe. If they lose, they throw the board. There goes Monopoly player pieces everywhere. I like to win, but you don't have to cheat. And really, it's not. You don't have to be all that competitive. But yeah, you kind of, I think as a guy, I sort of had to outgrow that. I was much more competitive when I was a kid, younger. Not even just a kid, but I was very competitive. But I was raised in that, we were in the military and they had constant games and competitions and stuff. And so we were raised in a kind of a competitive environment. Well, the wreath was presented to the winners on the last day of the games. At that time, the victors were crowned in an elaborate ceremony. For us, we have an idea of what this means. B, in the morning, the victors, judges, and members of the various groups proceeded in a solemn procession, a parade to the Temple of Zeus, which was observed by all of the spectators that were present at the games. At the temple, the judge, wearing a purple robe, placed the wreath on the victor's head. The wreath was made from a single branch, around which olive leaves, sometimes it was celery leaves. The victor's wreath wasn't, first, it was perishable. And that's Paul's very important point here. Their victories are perishable. Their awards are perishable. Their fame is perishable. Ours will not be. That's what we strive for. To the Greeks, the wreath signified magical associations. It linked the victor with the god at the moment it was placed on his head. Obviously, small G-O-D there. This was considered to be one of the greatest moments in the life of the victorious athlete. He not only felt the pride and joy of his victory, but also the sense of pious awe induced by what he considered as a divine sacrament. And so this was all very religious to them as well. This is, when we think of games and athletics, we don't tend to tie it to religious observances. But for them, this was all linked with their relationship to the gods And if they served a certain god, that god accrued some fame because of his Olympic victory that he provided for the guy, theoretically. Well, we don't buy that, but all that. Well, although the crown provided spiritual, emotional, financial, and social benefits, Paul indicates that this earthly attainment paled in comparison to the heavenly reward for the faithful believer. Verse 25, we are competing for an imperishable wreath, a crown of glory that does not fade away. And again, I still would like to, maybe if somebody can figure it out, let me know. You know, are there different crowns? Is it a single crown looked at from different standpoints? But all that. But what we do know is that the crown is imperishable. It doesn't fade away. It doesn't lose its luster. That when you get a victory in God's plan and are rewarded for it, that reward stays. You won't get tired of it. It won't wear out. Anything you buy, anything that happens, let's face it, this is a temporal world. And our joys are temporary, so is our sorrows, fortunately. Our successes are temporary, so are our failures. So we shouldn't get too up about the one and too down about the other sometimes. The goal is to win. We make no secret of this. Well, the second metaphor, which parallels and complements the first, is expressed by the verb kapiao, which deals with labor from the standpoint of the fatigue that comes from hard work. There should be a which in there. Which deals with labor? I don't know how I missed that, but okay. It referred to the type of exertion that was necessary to perform strenuous and difficult labor, which would leave one tired, weary, or exhausted. It's used in Luke there 5:5. Here in the context of the fishermen working overnight, which of course meant they worked during that day before and then they'd worked all night. And Simon answered and said, Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing. But I will do as you say and let down the nets. And when they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish. In other words, Peter's also saying, I'm worn out, and you know, but you say do this, I'll do it. I'm exhausted, I'm tired, but I'll go ahead and do it. And well, obviously, they were rewarded for that. For those involved in the ministry, the labor would include the physical labor that is necessary so one can support himself and have some resources for helping others. This is one of those things that some pastors I've met had almost the attitude that they deserve full maintenance, and that if they didn't have it, they wouldn't teach. And that's never guaranteed. And Paul never had that attitude at all. Acts 20:24, and you yourselves know how these hands ministered to my own needs. And I ministered to the men who were with me. I met their needs. In everything, I showed you that by working hard in this manner, you must help the weak. And remember the words of the Lord Jesus, that he himself said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. And of course, what many people fail to grasp, it is blessed to receive. Receiving is a blessing. And we have to look at it that way, rather than, oh, you can't do anything for me. Mm-hmm. Phony humility. Or the pride that won't allow you to do something for others, or won't allow you to let them do something. As you grow older, I'm more and more happy to have help when I need it. I was young and headstrong, and I could do anything, I know. But you outgrow that. And, well, God kicks a lot of it out of you, I think. He drop kicked me through the goalpost a couple of times, and it takes the starch out of you. Also, 1 Corinthians 4:12. And this was one of Paul's boasts, that in his ministry, he never violated this. If he was on full maintenance, fine. If he wasn't, he worked. If he could teach during the day, he would work in the evening. If he could teach in the evening, he'd work during the day. And he did what he had to do. And that was his mentality, whatever it takes. We toil, he says, working with our own hands. And as an apostle, he had, you know, the right, the authority and all that to say, no, I don't have to. But he didn't choose to use that. Ephesians 4:28, let him who steals steal no longer so that he may have enough to help others. 1 Thessalonians 2:9. You recall, brothers, our labor, again, kapiao, our hard work and our hardship, how working day and night so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God, and of course, he never charged a penny for any of this. I did add a line or two on a couple of our pages. People were requesting, you know, how to send in money. So we're not going to put a PayPal button, I don't think, but I'm not a big fan of that. But if people want to donate and contribute, I've realized, yeah, they can apply if they choose to. We would encourage them to get to Bible class, get face to face. But if they can't, that's one thing. If they won't, that's quite a different thing. Also, 2 Thessalonians 3:8. Nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with labor and hardship, we kept working night and day so that we would not be a burden to any of you. And I can say that even when we had very little here. We did what we had to do. There were times when Linda and I both worked. I worked full time at first, but then I worked part time. And then after 17 years or whatever it was, finally we had enough to be on full maintenance. And I'm grateful for that. With given all that we faced over the last 5 years, and the nightmare housing and Linda's issues, it would have been very difficult to be working another job. So I'm very grateful for that. It would also include point 40 here, the spiritual aspects of the ministry, which include the labor necessary to adequately fulfill the study-teach routine, the labor one expends in praying for others, and the labor necessary for properly shepherding the flock. You have these burdens that you have to bear, work that has to be done. And we recognize that, of course, when we're in fellowship and doing all this right, this is great glory for us. This is great reward laying up. But we request of you, brothers, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another. 1 Timothy 5:17. Again, the elders who rule well, worthy of a double honorarium. Expressed, obviously, financially, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. And you can also see 1 Peter 5, 2, and 3. That deals with the fact that you have to shepherd the flock of God. And the way you do that, and how you handle that appropriately. And then 41, Paul knew that his efforts would be evaluated at the Bema Seat, and that his sound doctrinal teaching ministry would be rewarded. That's the 1 Corinthians 3 passage, where, again, years this was taught that all this was about SG3. It is, but not in the way it was taught. 1 Corinthians 3:8. And it's pretty clearly here, he uses two metaphors, an agricultural one and a building metaphor. You are God's field, verse 9, God's building. And according to the grace of God given to me, like a wise master builder, I lay the foundation. And that foundation is Christ. But another communicator is building on it. And every man must be careful how he builds on it. And so the materials become evident. Gold, silver, precious stones, things that are valuable and become more valuable when tried by fire and become purified. Wood, hay, straw, not worth much, and also destroyed by fire. And of course, we know the test is one of fire. It's one of righteous judgment. And so if you work on it, it remains. If you build with the right materials in the lives of believers. And by extension, of course, believers have to determine what kind of level of doctrine they're going to be settled for. Some people just settle because they don't want to pay the price. Well, you shouldn't settle. You can get quality doctrinal teaching. Not everywhere, but you can get it. It's available. It's available here. So in that regard, the passage in Corinthians explicitly indicates that there will be men who labored in the ministry, but who deviated from the principles of sound doctrine by teaching improper content. I think reading the role of medal, the role of honor for the people who've won the Medal of Honor is a waste of Bible class time, for instance. Lots of things are a waste of Bible class time. Printing out equations is a waste of Bible class time. And I may comment on things here and there, but usually it's current events or something. And I try not to get too far afield and waste much time with it. But the fact is, the pastor's allowed to comment, but he just shouldn't make it to where it gets him away from the text, that it deviates from what he's supposed to be doing. So again, they will teach improper content, and their labor will prove to be vain. If any man's work is burned up, he will suffer loss. Now, he's a Christian, but he's saved. He's going to have salvation, be in heaven, but he's going to suffer loss of rewards. So if the Philippians persevere in the Christian way of life and continue to hold fast the word of life, they will be proof that Paul's apostolic ministry and hard work were successful and bore fruit. They will be the fruit, in fact, of his labor. So that principle is still operative today. The spiritual success of the congregation will demonstrate the validity of the pastor-teacher's doctrinal ministry. They are the basis for the pastor's glory and sanctified boasting at the Bema seat. 1 Thessalonians 2. And the congregation here, we're all in this together. Never has been any other way. The pastor that isn't in it for the congregation should get out of the ministry. If he's not there to teach and do what he's supposed to be doing. For who is our hope or our joy or our crown of exaltation? Is it not even you in the presence of our Lord Jesus at his coming? For you are our glory. You bring glory to us by your application, faithfulness to the teaching. And you are our joy. You make us happy when you do that. When people apply, I'm happy. I'm glad to see it. There's enough discouragement in this world. So seeing believers doing it right is helpful. Well, on the other hand, if the Philippians did not persevere in the Christian way of life, it would mean that the portion of his ministry directed toward them had not ultimately borne the fruit that Paul desired and had not produced the desired result. Paul has confidence in them. You can tell by the way he's written so far, I think. I don't think Paul's saying, but he does let them know there is still this future ahead of us that we have to account for. And I don't want to get up there and suffer loss. And you shouldn't either. So the repetition of the adjective kenos, empty or without content, which is used figuratively to refer to things or actions that lack effectiveness, is designed to emphasize the real potential for failure. He uses that term twice in there, that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. And the repetition of it's designed to draw attention to the fact that that is a distinct possibility. Okay, well, good. Our time's up. We'll have the doctrine of boasting. I knew it was somewhere in here, so this verse makes good sense. We'll do that and start on that Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would strengthen us with the principles of the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.